Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxfordshire for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm chairman of the Natural Gas Programme at the Institute. It's my great pleasure to be joined today by Michael Maiden, who's director of the China Energy Programme at the Institute, to discuss her recently published energy brief, China's Oil Demand in the Wake of COVID-19. Michael, great to have you here. Let's start by looking at how oil demand is faring in China as it emerges from lockdown. What is demand looking like?
It's actually looking very, very strong. It's looking a bit like a V-shaped recovery, but I think it's important here to distinguish between crude imports, which have been stellar, and end product demand, which has been picking up a little bit more gradually.
That's interesting. But in your paper, you note the Chinese government fiscal support measures and monetary easing seems to be paying off, and that China's Q2 2020 GDP is actually pointing to very strong recovery. So, you know, we may be seeing this growth, but is the recovery sustainable, do you think?
I think when we look at the kind of macro economy and the epidemic seeming to be under control, it does seem to be sort of progressing well in that, again, things are getting back to normal, industrial activity is picking up. But I think there is a risk of a two-track recovery here because the government support measures are very much focused at infrastructure, industry, state-owned activities. It's much harder to get consumer demand in the private sector to be as active as quickly.
So what are the drivers of the strong demand for crude, and can it last then?
I think the strong crude buying that we've seen is unlikely to last. I mean, it's been on the back of very low oil prices and related to that stockpiling, which is obviously the fact that there are low prices and it's easy to stockpile, and also US-China sort of strategic concerns. We talked about the Shanghai futures contract and some of the dislocations in a previous podcast. That helped, but we are reaching a point where just tanks are filling up and we're coming close to, you know, what you call tank tops, and that will slow down some of the buying.
Now, the next question I wanted to ask you is the difficult about US-China relations and whether that's positive or negative, but do the tank tops also link back to security of supply as well because of those relations?
It's positive. So the US-China tensions are positive for flows. Again, in that China is so worried about supply disruptions that it's stocking up. Also, because China does still want to fulfill some of its commitments, at least in the phase one deal. It's buying a lot of US crude right now. But again, that's finite.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned the stimulus package, Michael. So what products are recovering first, and what does that tell us about the stimulus package which you referred to a few minutes ago?
So I think there are two sides to the stimulus package, right? One is the short-term impact of kind of a fiscal stimulus and easing of monetary policy that was quite temporary, was quite limited in time. And that is going back to construction activities, real estate, kind of good old infrastructure stimulus that we used to see out of China. But I think that's very much a short-term phenomenon. But that is helping kind of diesel and the bottom of the barrel, right? The heavier and industrial fuels. Going forward, I think the stimulus package and the recovery package is slightly different. We're looking at sort of a more fundamental change to the way the Chinese economy is structured and run. And that will have sort of a different outlook for the way energy and oil are consumed medium term.
Well, let you mention medium term. Why don't we talk about that for a few minutes? Because the domestic demand outlook, you say in your paper, is by no means bearish, with demand for gasoline, diesel, jet fuel and fuel oil already inching up from 2019 levels. But, you know, it's also far from the stellar recovery that crude buying or refinery runs would imply. That I think is interesting. There's a bit of a negative there, Michael. So, you know, what is the medium term outlook for oil demand in China?
I guess if we start on the positive side, you know, the fact that the economy is recovering and that there is this confidence again, it does suggest that, you know, everything that medium term and long term oil demand forecasts for China are based on remains true. That is that rising incomes, urbanization still fuel demand for oil. That is transport, tourism, consumer goods, all of that is still true, right? All of that still happens. We also have to bear in mind that the government's focus is not on this short-term infrastructure boom indefinitely. They are talking about electrifying the economy, and that actually weighs on oil demand in the medium term. So we've got a bit of a two-track, right? We've got a short-term strength, but that does not mean that that lasts for the next sort of 10 to 20 years.
Okay. But the question is the focus of the government, isn't it? So, you know, does the government focus, the focus on economic recovery and heavy industry, really suggest a strong outlook for China's oil demand? Is heavy industry going to be there to support that oil demand?
Not in the medium term. Again, there's still, you know, when we think about population growth and urbanization, we've still got a good 5 to 10 years for that to run. But that will peak. And even before that peaks, there is still, we've talked about this before quite a bit, the policy priorities. There is a commitment to tackling pollution and to making the heavy industry, while it's still around, more efficient and cleaner. And so that does suggest that, you know, oil demand growth continues, but at a much slower pace than what we've seen over the past 10, 20 years.
Yeah. Now, you say in your paper, you know, quote, whether China's oil demand will increase by closer to 3 or 4 million barrels per day is extremely significant for global markets, especially in the context of the global energy transition and concerns about peak oil demand, that about China's approach to energy transition. So what is the energy transition story here? Can we just revisit that for a minute in China?
I think there are two sides to the energy transition story. One is, again, the electrification of the Chinese economy that we've talked about a lot in previous podcasts as well. And it's China laying now the foundations for, you know, the digital infrastructure, the ecosystems to manage that electrification. But it doesn't mean that decarbonization moves ahead as quickly. But certainly, so when we talk about the power sector, there are certain implications for oil demand, though. Electrification is extremely significant.
Now, I'd like to now take the podcast in that direction, if I can, because I think the fascinating thing about your paper was a lot of discussion about electric vehicles. So let's discuss that for a few minutes. You know, what are the main trends in the auto sector? And is basically the government bailing out? Does that mean that EV penetration is going to be slow? You know, all these things, what's happening in the EV sector in China?
Again, I think that, you know, this goes back to what we were saying earlier, that we've got short-term dynamics that seem to be pointing in one way of very strong growth, and then the government plans and the medium-term outlook, which is slightly different. The government has focused on recovery. It means that it has gone, let's say, a bit more lenient on traditional ICE vehicles. There has been a bit more support, restrictions like license plate approvals that have been limited car sales in a lot of Chinese cities have been eased, and we're seeing car sales recover after two very, very weak years. But that doesn't mean that the government has given up on electric vehicles. And again, we noted this already at the beginning of the year. Subsidies were going to be phased out, and that led to a slowdown in sales. But they've actually extended subsidies for electric vehicles. But the government is still tweaking the mechanisms with which it encourages and supports electric vehicles. That is not changing, but it has meant that EV sales have slowed. So again, you sort of, when you look at it, you say, oh, but actually there's a huge amount of support for ICE vehicles right now. Again, I think that's a short-term phenomenon. And while the government still tweaks its support and subsidy mechanisms, there's still strong support for electric vehicles.
I hope so. As the owner of an electric vehicle, I know, once you get one, you never go back. That, I'll tell you now, that's my view. But anyway, well, look, I'd just like to kind of go back, if I can, to something we've talked about in previous podcasts and you've referred to briefly earlier on, and that's the Chinese government's new infrastructure plan. Now, could you perhaps just remind us of the key elements of this plan and how that could impact on oil demand?
So the new infrastructure and also new urbanization, I guess, it really focuses on 5G infrastructure, artificial intelligence, big data centers, but also EV charging stations, high-speed rail, and transmission lines for the power sector. And none of this is essentially new. There are a lot of plans that were existing to add infrastructure, but because this is now a priority also for recovery, for economic recovery, it's highly likely that the financing is available, and that a lot of projects that were perhaps stalling or rather slow will get expedited and approved very quickly. So the infrastructure will get built. And that in turn will help the penetration of electric vehicles and electric. And it's not just sort of private EVs. It's also the municipal, the public buses, the sanitation. I mean, that has been a key focus for the Chinese. And I think that's going to be critical in electric mobility penetration in China.
So what is the outlook for urban mobility in China? And importantly, you know, are we going to see that impacting on gasoline demand?
I think we're certainly going to see a slower growth outlook for gasoline demand. I mean, gasoline demand in China is already expected to peak in the mid-2020s, even as oil demand only peaks somewhere in the mid-2030s. But the fact that there is more infrastructure and that is ongoing support for EVs will support that in terms of urban mobility. I think the other interesting thing that's happened is that there's a lot of innovation. There's a lot of local innovation. I think when we think EVs, we think, how do I take the car that I know and that I'm used to using and just replace the engine, right? Just replace the way it runs. In China, there's a lot of discussion about how EVs will be integrated with 5G networks and how sort of 20 minutes from home, they'll already turn your rice cooker on and your heater on in winter. And it's just a whole different universe of mobility.
It's really a completely different way of thinking about it. And this brings me actually to the next point I wanted to discuss with you, which is AI, artificial intelligence, because I was actually fascinated by the reference to that in your excellent paper and the whole use of big data technologies and how that's impacting on transport platforms in China. Can you perhaps share with our listeners more about this?
This is very anecdotally, it's extremely interesting. Obviously, there's not enough data to see how this impacts gasoline demand right now or in the long term. But we saw this a few years back already, the emergence of bike sharing platforms in China. But those were very much used for what was called the first and last mile. You use them to travel from your home to the train station or from the train station to the office. But that already created a digital sort of ecosystem for sharing apps. And now they're used for e-scooters and e-bikes. And with the return from COVID, people aren't using public transport, but they are using e-bikes and e-scooters, not just for the first and the last mile, but for the entire transit that they have to undertake. And that has really changed the way people look at urban mobility, but also it puts them on an electric pathway. So instead of going from a bike to a car, they'll go from an e-bike or an e-scooter, potentially to an electric vehicle, or to staying on these shared mobility platforms. And I think that is transformative when we think of China's scale and the fact that these e-bikes and e-scooters, even if you wanted to buy them, they are much cheaper than sort of vehicles. And so I think that will change the way Chinese cities look and how Chinese drivers think about urban mobility.
It's fascinating, isn't it? If you look at kind of the development of transport in countries, you know, people go from bicycles to mopeds, to motorbikes, to cars. And now what you're saying effectively is you're going almost backwards, or maybe you could see it going forward, onto scooters. It's a completely different way of thinking, isn't it, Mikhail?
Yeah, and I think we'll see it potentially in the West as well, with everything becoming a bit more localized. Micro offices, you know, with people not wanting to commute back to big offices. We're seeing that already, some of those e-scooters and e-bikes in our cities.
Because something you did mention is a rail example, using your scooter going to the station, you know. So what about the shift from road to rail? Because that is another fundamental thing we're seeing in China. Can you share with us your views on kind of the move to transporting goods by rail? And that's obviously going to have impacts on diesel demand, isn't it?
Exactly. I think the electrification push does not just impact gasoline. It's a much bigger story because freight is a huge part of diesel consumption in China, but also of pollution and emissions. And again, there have been ongoing government programs to accelerate the build out of railway and to displace freight, just move it to rail or to water. With the additional kind of rail lines and the build out of infrastructure, that becomes easier. Now, that doesn't happen overnight. There are still price differentials and there's still, you know, trucking is easier. But over time, and especially if we get some form of reform in the transport system and the pricing of it, we've still, again, the government here is laying the foundations for this shift to be accelerated and electrified.
Yeah. And I assume that the new high speed lines that we're referring to will also impact on demand for air travel as well in China, won't it?
Certainly. I mean, the high-speed rail, which, you know, will be used for domestic travel, I think that could certainly move ahead and limit some of the potential growth in jet. And jet and chemicals, really, transport fuels and chemicals are the key sources of demand that everybody anticipates in the future. But with high-speed rail being very effective, I mean, there was an anecdote, this was already a few years back when the high-speed rail first started, about an old lady in Nanjing in southern China that wanted to take the tube, but accidentally got on high-speed rail and found herself 2 hours away from home. I mean, this will become easier to travel. And if jet is off people's menu for now, but high-speed rail accelerates and is cheap and reliable, then I think it will again dent some of the potential demand growth for jet.
Yeah, I can see that. Well, look, let's step back kind of more to kind of macro level if we can. And, you know, how should we think that China's oil demand is going to be over the next decade or two? You know, how does that compare maybe to demand over the past decade or two? You know, are we seeing a fundamental difference, a fundamental change?
I think we're going to see two major changes. The first is in the pace. So in the past two decades, China's oil consumption grew by close to 10 million barrels a day. In the next two decades, we're looking at, again, 3 to 4 million barrels a day. And our view is that electrification moves it to the kind of lower end of that scale, closer to 3 rather than 4 million barrels a day. So already it's a very different pace. In the context of sort of global oil demand growth going forward, that's still relatively constructive. That's still a relatively good story. But again, it's much slower than what we've become accustomed to. The other shift is in the makeup. China's growth was predominantly industrial fuels, diesel, fuel oil, bitumen, with gasoline expected to be one of the big areas of growth alongside jet and chemicals. I think jet and chemicals, or especially chemicals, everything that makes plastic bottles, polyester for clothing, the wrapping that, you know, for consumer goods that are moved around the country, household goods, all of those, again, they still continue to grow from urbanization. And I think gasoline is one of the big questions, and to what extent electrification of mobility reduces demand for gasoline going forward. But in essence, the product makeup is also changing from kind of medium and heavy to the lighter ends of the barrel.
And that, of course, is going to impact on the structure of refining. So, you know, let's talk about that for a minute. How is China's domestic refining capacity going to change? You know, are refiners adapting to changes in oil demand? And also, we haven't really talked about COVID. You know, will COVID also slow refining additions?
In a way, the Chinese refiners are not adapting to changes because they're still adding capacity. There is already this year, we're going to see 500 or even 700 barrels a day of new refining capacity at a time when oil demand growth in China will be flat. That is still continuing. And so there's still an ambition to become a global refining hub. But of course, if we are looking at lower oil demand growth going forward, that means that the domestic oversupply will increase. The one area where we are seeing a shift is in the transition to chemicals. Refiners are adding more integrated capacity that allows them to produce sort of further downstream into the chemical supply chain. And I think that has been slightly accelerated during COVID.
Now, it's interesting because, of course, we have in the COVID period seen kind of weak regional and global refining margins. And so, you know, and the market has seen oil products, therefore exports from China slow down. So, what's going to happen? Are we going to continue seeing a slowdown? Where are we headed, do you think, on exports of products from China?
I mean, if we're right about, you know, the extent of the supply addition, so the fact that China's been buying a lot of crude, refining way more than it actually needs, and we're already seeing product stocks quite full in China, then the only kind of mechanism now is to export it. Refiners did try to hold back because export margins were bad, but I think it's inevitable that they will start exporting more. And going forward, as they add more refining capacity, and that refining capacity is more versatile, the government is also moving away from some of the sort of product export quotas that it used to give. So it used to regiment pretty rigidly how much companies could export, and they had to apply in advance, or they had to plan you can't plan for things like COVID and the way it's ravaged the international market. So if they have more flexibility and their refining capacity is much more sophisticated, then I think they will be more nimble in their exports. In the short term, I think we're certainly going to see outflows increase. And in the medium term, I think that is going to be a lasting lasting factor in regional and global markets. And Chinese products are going to go further afield than Asia. I think they're going to start to hit, sort of reach Europe and the Americas as well.
Well, they're going to have to, aren't they? Because, you know, if you have these extra volumes of products going out into the Asian markets, they're going to be competing head on, of course, with products produced in other countries. And so they're going to have to go further afield. And so, but it's not a good story when you talk about refining margins, is it? It certainly sounds like it's going to be weak. They're going to be weak for some time to come, isn't it?
Yes, and it seems likely that the Chinese refiners will be among the last standing. I mean, their economics are different. The economic calculations are at times different. The sunk costs are obviously different to European refiners. And so they are in a position to flood, I think, global markets, or at least to inflict a lot of pain on other both regional and European refiners who have become among the more vulnerable.
But do you think, you know, if we've got modern capacity coming on, there's obviously some older refining capacity. Could you see a scenario where some of the older refining capacity in China is closed down? Could you see that happening?
Absolutely. There's still a huge consolidation push. But actually that older refining capacity, the people tend to think that's the independent refiners. Not necessarily. Some of the state-owned majors have older capacity that hasn't been ramped up and that might have to shut down before the independents do.
Well, look, Mikhail, you know, the witching hour is coming upon us as we get to the end of this podcast. But I always like to end up with my last question, kind of looking forward, if possible. And so I expect my question is, what is the end game? I love the title of your concluding paragraph in your excellent paper, which was An Altered Outlook. So what is altered and why, and where are we going to end up?
I think what's altered is the scale and pace of things, right? As we said before, the overarching trend is still there. China continues to grow. It continues to consume oil demand, and that shift from industrial fuels to consumer goods continues. But with electrification, it does probably slow down. Both the overall pace of oil demand growth goes from, again, closer to 4 million barrels a day to closer to 3 million barrels a day, while the product makeup changes. At the same time, with China adding more refining capacity and shifting to chemicals, it will be in a position to both export more products, both on the refined oil product side and on the chemical side. Because again, we have to also bear in mind that China is constantly thinking about the tensions with the US, energy security and self-sufficiency, and is looking to become increasingly self-sufficient in all these products. Now, whatever flows over will hit other refiners and other producers, but that is a secondary concern for China.
Interesting. Well, it's a great story, Mikhail. Look, thank you so much for your time. You know, I, as always, I really enjoyed our conversation that builds on the messages from the Energy Brief, China's Oil Demand in the Wake of COVID-19, that I urge you, all the listeners, to read, because it's really a good read. Now, I hope you've all enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.